Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to your Partner in Success Radio, hosted by serial entrepreneur Denise Griffiths. Denise offers a full menu of on-the-web services for all your online needs. Denise and her team of virtual assistants can help manage your online business, including social media channels, blogs, web portals, and more. YourOfficeOnTheWeb.com is a comprehensive resource to help you combine the power of your brand, your connections, and innovative ideas to develop a full online strategy that can guarantee a strong profitable impact on your business.
Good morning and welcome to your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and each week I'm honored to share the microphone with the most interesting people. These are people who are entrepreneurs, solopreneurs, authors, speakers, small business owners, virtual assistants, web developers, and just honestly anyone who has a wonderful story to share and who are very excited to freely share their business wisdom as well as their tips and actionable advice. In short, they are willing to help us shorten our learning curve as we navigate the know, like, and trust economy. And today I'm excited. I get to welcome Andrea Goulet to the show. Now, Andrea Goulet is the CEO of CorgiBytes, a software development shop that is dedicated to maintaining and modernizing software applications. And don't be fooled by her decade of marketing experience. She slings some pretty solid code. We're nerds. Both of us are nerds. That's why I'm so excited. She is the founder of Legacy Code Rocks and hosts a podcast dedicated to changing the way we think about legacy code. She speaks frequently about building a business based on balance, empathy, and trust. The perils of the technical and non-technical divide, I see that all the time, and the technical philosophies around working with legacy code. And in her spare time, Andrea enjoys helping other people learn how to code and blogging at empathy-driven development. She loves watching her kids explore the world and is a sucker for a good physics documentary. We have so much in common. You can recognize her by the JavaScript tattoo on her wrist. Andrea, welcome to the podcast. You know, I'm a nerd. I'm a big-time nerd. I'm a nerd in stilettos. You have no idea how excited I am to talk to you today.
I am so excited to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, I think it's going to be fun, and I was chatting with, you know, I thought, I wonder if this is a topic that will appeal to a lot of people. And I had a chat with a friend this morning. He is typically in the chat room with all of these things. He said, I love this topic. I went, oh, good. I was hoping it wasn't just me. Apparently, it's not just us. So before we get rocking and rolling, please tell our audience a bit about yourself that I may have missed in the introduction.
Yeah. So I have a strong background in strategic communications, which is why I think, honestly, I've been able to make sense of the legacy code world. Had gone through school and got a degree in marketing and then worked at several agencies and learned really about branding and storytelling and the use of metaphor. And in my, eight, 9 years ago now, I reconnected with a really good friend from high school, and he asked me to join his business. He's really, really good at the programming, but he said, I don't have a technology problem, I have a marketing problem. And so we joined forces, and over the course of the past, 8 years, have really refined this idea of how can you tackle legacy code. And the thing that makes this particular problem so well attuned is that legacy code isn't just a technology problem. It's also a communications problem and an operations problem. And so you have to have a very broad understanding of the business, of business value and the technology side of things. And the fact that Scott and I both bring such diverse skill sets to the table is one of the things that makes CorgiBytes able to create some solutions around what has for a long time been a very intractable problem.
And let's go back to your name, CorgiBytes. Corgi's a dog. Do you have corgis?
Yes.
I figured.
Yeah, we have Scott named the business before I came on board, and the name was already CorgiBytes. And the story goes is that his corgi, who's named Ayn after Cowboy Bebop, if we have any anime fans who are listening, he was trying to create a kind of funny name, like Red Hat. Like, he noticed that like there were kind of in the naming of things, you would pick two just random things and put them together. So he was like, well, I have a corgi and I like her, and then Bytes, like the, you know, computer. And when I came on board, I was like, all right, I don't know if I like that, but if we do it, we're going to go all the way. So the dog is everywhere. She's our mascot. Our tagline is old code, new tricks. And it's really worked. Mm-hmm. So it's been very distinctive and fun. So I think
it is
out. Yeah.
And so, I looked at it and I went, okay, that makes sense. But surely to God, there's a corgi in that family.
There is.
Okay.
And she's awesome. She's great. She's almost 11 now, but yeah, she climbs up on top of the table on the patio and then just like jumps off. It's her favorite thing to do. So yeah, she's still very sprightly and a lot of fun. We love her.
Oh, they're fantastic dogs. Now, you wound up marrying Scott, right?
I did. Yes.
So you guys are married and partners.
We are, yeah, we are partners in all sense of the word. We, Scott had asked me out when we were in high school, and I said no. And when we started the business together, we were business partners for 2 years, and then it was pretty clear that, like, this was the person I was supposed to spend the rest of my life with. So, yeah, so we decided, well, we're already in business together, and we're spending pretty much all of our waking hours together, you know, especially when you're in a startup. And we just were having so much fun, and we loved it. So we decided to get even more legally entangled. So we got married, and then a couple years later, we had our first child, and then last year, we had our second child. So, we spend a lot of time. Our life is a little chaotic, but we love it.
You know, that's the best way to do it if you can. My ex-husband was a software developer, and I'm a nerd, so that worked until it didn't. But yeah, I totally get it.
Yeah.
Okay. So
yeah,
let's,
and I think that's.
Let's
the,
talk.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, just the
no.
Thing, like the yeah, and I think the thing that's neat is that like I came from my background. Like my parents had a business when I was growing up, and so one of the things that I love is that the way we've set everything up, it's much less about work-life balance, which feels very compartmentalized, and it's more about work-life integration. So, you know, we have our kids playing downstairs while I'm on a call, and we have babysitters, and of course, but they're there, and they, you know, I'm able to watch my son kind of grow up and be part of the business, and he is learning how to use my computer, and just it feels very integrated as opposed this is my work life and this is my home life and this is this and never the twain shall meet. It just feels like my life is my life, and I get my work done and I talk to clients and I get business and I interact with my team and I am a parent, and I don't feel that I necessarily have to put on different masks, because I feel like at every point during the day I'm just myself. Which is kind of a neat feeling.
It is, and I'm reading a lot of research and a lot of articles recently that are indicated with the way things are changing in our world. You know, we're no longer largely a society that, you know, gets up every morning, goes to somebody else's office and works there all day and then comes home, cooks, cleans, takes care of the kids. We are integrating more and more of our personal into our business, and that's not a bad thing. And we're going to talk about that when it comes to empathy, I'm sure. But let's go back. Let's kind of it's important. But let's kind of start at the top. What is legacy code to anybody who may be listening and is just kind of has an idea that we're talking about software code, you know, software engineering, that kind of thing? But what is legacy code, just so we can kind of clean that question up?
Sure. So when I first came to software, I thought that legacy code was archaic, it was old, it was like punch cards, mainframes, you know, things that like COBOL and Fortran. And that's kind of what most people think of when they think of legacy code. Now, legacy code, really, it doesn't have an age defined on it. So you can have legacy code that is 40 years old. You can have legacy code that is 2 years old. But really what it is it's code that is difficult to work with. That's probably the simplest definition. And I go a little bit further and I say it's code that's difficult to work with because you don't have a lot of communication artifacts that help you understand context of the business problem that that piece of code is solving. So there's a very famous, like in the legacy code circles, you know, one of the best, you know, definitions that kind of gets passed around is that is from Michael Feathers from his book, Working Effectively with Legacy Code. And he says that it's code without tests, which is good because if you put tests around your code, so if it's, think of it this way, like when I was in math class, I was taught to double check my work before I like submitted it in, right? And just to verify that I had the right answer, right? So we do the same thing when we write code, and that's called test-driven development. There's a whole, like, I could do a whole show just on that. But essentially what test-driven development does is it forces you just to double-check your work before you submit it to the code base. And that reduces the error rates. It helps make sure that you don't introduce bugs into your system. It's good stuff. And so
you would think that that would be intuitive, but after having lived with that for as long as I did, it's amazing to me to hear stories about how many people don't make notes around their code, don't explain what they're doing, don't kind of fill in somebody else on the big picture objective.
Yeah, the reason for that is because years and years ago, the way that software projects were run, it was less, thing was an afterthought. So it was almost, they built
That's
it.
That's not logical. That's not even logical.
Yeah, it's not. It's totally not. It's totally not. But basically, you would put together first your big list of requirements and say, this is what we need to do, and you would project out exactly what you need. And then you would build the thing, and then you would test it. And that, and the success rate on that was about 8%. Like, and that's
high,
if you've ever heard the term, yeah, if you've ever heard the term waterfall, you know, that is kind of the waterfall method. And it doesn't work very well. It works well for some physical construction projects, which they were trying to, but we've learned that with software, that's not right. Like, we don't have as much of a success rate. So instead, what works much better in software is taking a tiny, tiny piece of code, testing it, committing it, and working in very, very, very small and discrete chunks and just focusing on making it better over time. And rather than having an end date, thinking about it, and this is why I use the term software remodeling, because, you know, your when is your house, quote, done? You're always going to find something to be better. You're always going to find some little project. Like, oh, I need to paint the fence, you know. Oh, I wish the shutters were a different color. Oh, you know, the dishwasher is getting old. That's always, it's the same thing with software, and that's the way that Corgibytes approaches code, is that rather than planning it out to this one big and now we're done, saying, okay, this is a business. This is something that I'm going to be living in, and the code is done when I decide to stop the business and no longer make money on it, you know. And if you take that approach and just look at it in terms of a bunch of small things that you're doing over time, then things become a lot more manageable, and it becomes a lot more fun to work on, and you end up in a virtuous cycle of, you know, having a place where you love to live and the code is easy to work with and it's a good place to collaborate, and rather than kind of being messy. So
and you're not breaking things. You know, I mean, if you mess with one piece of code, something, you know, 4 years back can break.
Yeah. And so that's where testing comes in really, really handy. And just recognizing that this type of development where you're testing as you go along and just double checking your work and just it's a slow and steady, you know, yeah, this might break over here. Sometimes I think of it as like if I ever want to clean out a closet, for example, like I could have the closet closed but I know it's there's something behind there. And in order for me to clean it out, it's like there's this point where things have to become messier than they are in order for me to organize things and put everything together. And that's kind of the same thing with a code base. When you're cleaning it out, you'll find bugs and you'll find things happen in other parts of the system. And if you allow your developers to have the freedom and the autonomy to look at the code base and fix underlying problems, then your code becomes much healthier overall, as opposed, you know, because then they can actually solve the underlying problem rather than just the surface level problem. So yeah, it's a lot like caring for a house that you're going to live in for a really, really long time, and you're prioritizing which fixes are going to bring the most business value. And, you know, I think that the thing that I like the most about working on legacy code is that, you know, code has been difficult to work with because it provides business value, right? Like the code bases wouldn't, you know, these are the code bases where they're providing value to a business. They are generating revenue. You know, it's not some, you know, glossy little social media app that, I mean, I've worked on social media apps before. I'm not saying that, but there's a vast majority of social media apps analogy, and they don't actually solve like a real business need. And for me personally, I get a lot of joy out of working on problems and working on software that really solves a good business need. And I feel like I'm making the world a better place. And so when you're looking at software remodeling, a lot of these problems have kind of already been solved, right, in terms of the business logic. And the way that software typically is now is, oh, here's this app and it's messy, so let's bulldoze it, let's scrap it, and let's rewrite it from scratch. And I say that that's really costly. Like, from a business standpoint, that tends to not make a lot of sense to me. And so instead, it's, well, hold on, let's look at this objectively and figure out what business logic we want to keep, and we can slowly make a transition. It doesn't have to be a hard cutoff. And so that's kind of where CorgiWrite has specialized in, is in inheriting some of these older projects. You know, so for example, we have one client, and they've been around for 25 years. They have some software. It's great. And they had one develop them in Delphi, which is kind of an older language. They have Fortune 500 clients. It's great. And now their developer, they've worked with them for 20 years, and their developer is retiring. Well, now what, right? So the challenge is that a lot of the, you know, folks who are graduating from software development, you know, with a CS degree, they aren't going to want to work on that type of project. And no. So CorgiWrite's, like, the problem we solved is finding people who love working on those types of projects. And so we can take that, and it's like, yeah, we'll maintain it, and we'll continue to make it better. And, you know, you don't have to stress out about your developer retiring. You know, you don't have to stress out. And the types of people that we hire are comfortable in 15-plus languages. So we code in any language, any platform, any framework. So we've got stuff all across the gambit that we work in. And it's been really neat. I think that's the thing I like, is that, you know, you don't get to a point where you've been in business for 25 years without having solved a really, really good and needed and interesting problem.
So basically, you're the this old house of the code world.
Exactly. Yeah, that was actually our inspiration. That we
I love that
sitting
show.
On. Yeah, I do too. We were sitting on the couch one day, and we were looking at our strategic plan, and like it just dawned on us. It was like light bulbs went off on both of us, and we were like, "This is what we do. We remodel software." And yeah, and I think this old house is a great example. You know, that you can breathe new life into an existing structure. You don't have to bulldoze it. And for many reasons, like you wouldn't want to bulldoze it, right? So.
Oh, no. I mean, even if you have one operating system up and running, or then that's not the right term, but one system up and running while you're replacing it with something else, what if you replace it and the new one just sucks. I mean, what happens then? Can you go back to the old
code?
Yeah, I've heard about that.
Yeah, and that's the challenge with a hard cutoff, right? And so what we do is that we put everything in place. Like, we're very test-focused, and so we advocate for what we call continuous improvement, continuous delivery. And so that means that you're slowly transforming your application over time, and you're putting in safety systems so that if you do introduce a bug, you know, like, well, first we've got, like, all the systems in place where you shouldn't, but in the event that you do, or in the event that something unexpected happens, you can roll back very quickly. And that's happened to us before. Like, we had one client, and they had a restaurant app, and, you know, we solved this problem over here, but that introduced something over here, which happens all the time, right? And so we said, no problem, we'll go back to the most stable version, and it took us 10 seconds. And then it was like, okay, go through the weekend, you'll be able to still, you know, you're not going to lose any revenue. And we'll work on this again, you know, on Monday when your clients aren't using your application as much. And we did that. We found the underlying problem, like that this bug was causing this other bug because of this, you know, interdependency. And I think that's one of the other things about legacy code is that it's very complex. A lot of times you have lots of different things that are working interdependently. And it's because there is a little bit of unpredictability. And so being able to just put guardrails around that and saying, okay, we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but we can control it, and we can sort of move it forwards over time. The other analogy that I use sometimes is that your body is constantly in a state of transformation. Like, you don't have a single cell in your body that is the same from where it was 7 years ago. Like, you have new parts in your body over time, but at no point did you, like, have to die and then have another body in order to become a different body, right? Like, it's just continuous improvement, continuous change, small little changes. You know, some things die out and other things get replaced, and you're able to grow, you're able to, you know, continue to move about. And I think that's the thing, especially when you have some software that is generating revenue, there is a huge, 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 huge risk if you are going to do a complete rewrite and a cutoff. And I've seen this so many times where people will go 2 weeks because they thought they planned it properly, but then they go 2 weeks where their website is down or something and they can't get the new one up. And, you know, as much as you test, there is business logic and there are, you know, things in the older system that are less observable, that no matter how much effort you put into, like, completely replicating them, it's going to be a challenge. And I personally have never seen a rewrite project go smoothly and go well.
Wow. Tell me, you've mentioned business logic a couple of times. Tell us what that is.
So think of it this way. Like, those are the rules that are specific to your business and your software, right? So we have, for example, we've built some software internally at Corgi Bytes to help people with their timesheets, because I hate nagging people to fill out their timesheets. It's, like, my least favorite thing to do in the world. So we built some software where if it monitors our timesheet application, and it says, if somebody has filled out their timesheet, then awesome. But if they haven't by this time, then send them a message in Slack so that everybody can see who has and hasn't filled out their timesheet. And since we started doing that and kind of putting it in a public room and saying, you know, so-and-so, please fill out your timesheet, now I don't have to do it anymore. And and all of a sudden the business problem just gets solved, right? And so that's something that is just kind of gone on autopilot, right? And we forget that, you know, there's business logic in there that we may start taking for granted, right? That if we were building a completely new system, we may look at that and go, oh, why is that important? Timesheets doesn't have anything to do with this system, let's get rid of that feature. But then, because it's so inherent to the way that we run our business, it would introduce some chaos. It would introduce things. So there's a lot there that it may seem unobvious, but once you kind of dig in, it becomes, and once you break it, then it becomes very obvious, right?
Yeah, no kidding. So do you have somewhere a document? Like, I've lived with this a long time. I know what you're talking. I've heard the screaming and the knuckle banging. All I was like, oh, geez.
Yep.
But do you have somewhere a document, like a business document that is accessible to your team that gives them the bigger picture? So this is why, these are our components. This is business logic. This is something else. So they can, you know, kind of peruse that and go, oh, well, that's why that's there. Instead of just going, well, that doesn't make sense to me because I'm a software engineer and I don't think like a business person. So do
yeah,
you have those safeties in place?
Oh, yeah, we do. We rely on a wiki, which I think is a great thing. So we have, you know, a wiki for all of our clients. So we take notes of all of our client meetings. We record as much as possible, right? But thinking about documentation, the code should be its best documentation. And so this is the other reason, is that if you have code that is difficult to read and difficult to work with, there is no amount of external documentation that is going to ever supplement good, clean, readable, self-intention-revealing code. And the challenge there is because you could – it's not very tightly coupled is what we say. So you could have the wiki article over here, which describes things, but then at the same time, you have the code base over here. And because they are two separate systems, you know, they can grow apart. So somebody forgets to update the documentation, right? Which happens all the time. Like, we're human. So the best documentation you can have is clean code. And the second best thing that you can do is when you are using, like we say, checking in your code, so using a source control system. So we like GitHub, but there are other types. There's Subversion, there's Bitbucket. But whenever you are putting your code in, like basically saving it, then you also document your rationale there because it is very tightly coupled. So external documentations can do a good job talking about kind of the big business reason, but the best place for documentation is actually within the code itself. And to make the code so that it's so easy to read that you don't really need the external documentation.
Well, that makes sense. Now, do you have any examples of, you know, where you took over something that maybe somebody else had broken? Maybe another software company had just gone in and bulldozed it down and you had to come back and kind of raise it from the ashes like a phoenix. Have you ever been in that position?
Yeah. Yeah, that happens frequently. What we see is that, you know, a legacy code problem usually manifests itself as an operations problem first as opposed to a technology problem. So we get this kind of call all the time. Features used to take me 2 to 3 weeks to push out, and now they're taking 8 to 10 weeks, and they're costing 5 times as much. And the CEO is like, I don't understand what's going on. I gave them my list of things that needs to happen, and I don't understand why, you know, why I'm having to pay more money. So... and a lot of times it's because the code itself is not written in a way that is really clean and easy to work with, right? And again, we can use that house metaphor. It's like, you know, if you don't clean up your dishes every night, you know, if you don't put away, you know, take out the trash and clear out the clutter, then yeah, it's going to be really difficult to like just walk through your house and do a general cleanup on a Saturday, right? And or do something new, like if you wanted to rearrange the living room. Well, if you've got all of this clutter all over the place, that takes a project that should have taken 2 hours, and now all of a sudden it's going to be 3 weeks because you've got to organize everything and put all this stuff away. So the same thing happens in a code base. There are small things that developers do every day that can seem, you know, it can seem like they're going faster, but they're actually not. And the, like, so one example would be what we call hard coding. So Let's imagine, I think most people are familiar with a male merge feature in a, you know, in a document system, like in Word or, you know, an email. So you can think of that. And instead of, if you were to write 100 letters and all of them said the same thing, but the only difference was the name, right? How much time would you save if you wrote out, if you opened up each letter and then typed the name in, opened up each letter, typed the name in, opened up each letter and typed the name in, versus writing a little piece of software that automatically injects where you list out, here are the names of all the people I need to send this letter to. Now automatically inserts that name in when I press the button and all 100 letters get populated.
Well, you see that in newsletter services, AWeb or Constant Contact, you know, first name,
right,
last name. You see that all the time.
Right. So the same thing kind of happens in software. So when you hear somebody say something is hard-coded, it means that they have not pulled out that information that could be put into what we call a function that would then automatically do it. So that's where you start creeping down the line. And so if you are building a new system and you're not thinking ahead about, well, how can I save time on this later? How can I save time on this later? So we inherit a lot of projects where there's a lot of things like hard coding, where they haven't put in variables that from a database that get called at specific times. Instead, they just, you know, make you go in and change it in the code base, which is a manual task and a waste of time. It's not something a human should be doing. You know, so we see a lot of that, a lot of copy and paste, you know, from other organizations. So yeah, we clean that stuff up all the time. And one of the neat things is, like, we had one client where we had inherited their project and they were really struggling to make any demos. They've been building this project for 2 years and they just felt like we're not making any momentum. And so we went through and walked with the product owner. And the first thing we did was we deleted a lot of features. And so it's the same thing as like clearing out the clutter in your house. Like, if you don't need this feature, if it's not a really high priority, we can get rid of it. And I think that's one of the mindsets, too, that people, when you're not thinking about things in a long-term state, it's like, oh, well, I have to have all these features in here now, right? And so we're like, well, you need the features that are going to be the most important. I think of it sometimes as, I don't know if you read that book, The Magic Art of Tidying Up by Marie Kondo. Sometimes she calls her thing KonMari, where she looks at everything in her house and she's like, does this give me joy? And then when you have less,
I'm familiar
in your house,
with it. I haven't read it, but
yeah,
I know what you're talking about. Because honestly,
yeah,
I will walk past things that maybe have a negative connotation for me. You know, they may be part of, you know, my former relationship. I'm like, you know, that no longer serves me, and I either get rid of it, donate it, sell it. You know, I move it out of my way, and I'm instantly happier.
Yeah,
so I think code kind of reacts the same way, doesn't it?
It absolutely does, and not as many people delete code. It's like people feel really nervous to delete code, but if you're using the source control correctly, if you're using the items test-driven development correctly, like you can very easily delete code to a point where it's safe, right? So
But you can also restore, though, too. So, I mean, don't you delete, restore, test, you know, sorry, delete, test, restore if you have to, and then try again.
Always testing, and always just making the code as clean and as easy to work with as possible. And then you can go really, really, really fast, right? So then, you know, once you see a bug, like let's say that, a user puts in and notices that there's a bug and it's a small one. Well, now instead of having to wait 10 weeks, you can put practices in place where it just gets automatically uploaded as soon as it's done. And then your customer is happy. It's like, oh, thanks for pointing that out. We've already fixed it. And that makes that puts you really high in terms of your customer service. People are going to think that you're really listening because you are, right? And so a lot of times when dealing with legacy code, it's not the talent of the developers. It's the business system that is in place that allows the developers to work. And so that's why, legacy code is a communications problem, an operations problem, and a technical problem. And unless you have everyone kind of on the same page, you're not able to kind of really move forward and solve this problem.
And that makes complete sense. So how long have you been doing this? Because this is, I'll be honest with you, this is not something I've heard of. I mean, not in the terms that you're couching, legacy code and, you know, software remodeling. I mean, I've heard a lot of talk about code over the years, but mostly it was, you know, a team going in and trying to kind of hack together some fixes, which I don't like
mm-hmm.
that. It makes me uncomfortable to even think about that.
Yeah. So I was the one who came up with the term software remodeling because that's what made sense to me. And it was a way for me to describe kind of what we're doing and say that, like, look, we're different. We're not just going to, like, hack together something. We're more like the professional organizers who are going to come in and do a very big system overview overhaul. Or, you know, we're more like the this old house where we're going to keep your existing structure, but we're going to make sure that you can get the most value over the most amount of time. So it's only been in the past maybe 3 years that I've started using these terms. The problem has been around for a really long time. And I think the challenge is that the people in the technical spaces have seen this and have said, we need help. This is bogging down our systems. But what happens is when business owners don't understand the value of creating software in this way, it is very tempting to say, oh, well, we don't really need testing. We can, if you have testing just as a line item instead of something that is an integral part of the way that you develop software in a responsible way, or, you know, it's very tempting for business owners just to say features, 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 features. That is the most important thing that we need. Our businesses, our clients, our users, they want features. And so, but they don't take the time to clean up after themselves, right? The other thing is that I've noticed, and in the past couple of years, we've started using the term of makers and menders, because there's actually two different types of software developers. And this is important for business owners to know, that you want to have the right type of software developer on the right project. So makers are people who get really energized by a brand new project. And I would say 90% of software developers probably identify as a maker, right? They like doing what are called greenfield applications. So it's the bright, shiny, do something new, build it to a prototype state, hack things together, just basically prove the idea. And then there are menders. And menders are the type of people like Corgi Bytes, like on the Corgi Bytes team. And menders are the ones who like to fix things, where, you know, they love doing bug fixes. They love diving in and making the code easy to read. They really enjoy cleaning up what, you know, we call it technical debt. You know, they love cleaning up the technical debt that the makers have left behind. But the challenge is that the business owners have such a hyper focus on feature development that when a mender says, hey, I think it would really behoove us to clean up as we go along, usually the person who controls the money says, we don't have time for that, not recognizing that if they did that, they would be so much further ahead. So it's, again, the remodeling metaphor kind of holds up. So it's one of these, like, let's say that you're trying to make your house more efficient, right? You're going to have to invest in some things that have a higher cost up front but are going to save you a lot of money over time. So things like replacing your windows to more energy efficient. You might have to replace your heat pump or your air conditioning system, your roof, right? Like, these are things that do tend to take a little bit longer of time, but once you do it, oh my gosh, you're like your electric can go down by hundreds of dollars a month, and you can make that money back very easily. So it's looking at things from a business point of view and then putting the right people on the right projects. Because if you put a maker who's really interested in kind of exploratory work on bug fixes, they're going to be really frustrated and they're probably going to leave. If you don't listen to someone who's saying, hey, we need to make sure that we are cleaning up our code as we go along, this is really important to the business. If that person is told, shut up, do your job, and just build features, which is Scott, my business partner and life partner, husband, everything partner, every job that he's had up until Corgibytes, that's what he's been told to do. He's been told, stop trying to make it better and just do what we say. And that's so frustrating. That's so demoralizing
to see that you
could make something better and nobody listens to you.
You know, that's why there's such a big turnover in the industry. People, it's my observation, and I'm sure you know better than I do, but it's my observation that a year, maybe two, and then they're burnt out and going somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You find that too?
Yeah, Scott, this is
the tech industry.
Well, and I think part of it too is because, you know, you want to make sure that you're managing in the right way, right? It is a lot about people, and it's understanding what makes an engineer happy. And the things that make an engineer happy are solving interesting problems, right? So
exactly.
You know,
engineers are not
that's...
like the rest of us, I have to say. I mean,
I
you guys are just
weird.
Well, you're
we
one, too.
Weird.
I mean, you're very different from the rest of us in a good way.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, having come from a marketing background, I am kind of bilingual in a way, right? Like, I speak marketing and I speak engineer. And one of my other goals is to really kind of break down that divide. One of the things that I hear constantly when I go into a new project or a new networking group or something, the first question out of somebody's mouth, are you technical or non-technical? And
but what is that all about? I get that too.
Yeah.
But on my side of the aisle, we're more closely related than you would think because I'm a web developer. I have a computer science
mm-hmm.
degree. I wear stilettos and long flowing dresses. I'm an anomaly. I mean, we both are. We were probably the only females in our graduating classes. I know I was. I mean, it's not what you think of when you think of women, you know, in technology. But I'm like you. I speak marketing. I mean, I'm a web developer. I'm an online business manager. I'm very conversant with, you know, how to get my clients, not only their gorgeous websites built, but, you know, get them noticed, get their sales funnels built. And I find in my world that there are a lot of very, very talented web developers who wouldn't be able to fight their way out of a marketing bag at all. They can build a gorgeous website, but frankly, too many of them are just beautiful boat anchors. They don't do a darn thing when it comes, you know, to what's needed. And the same thing on the virtual assistant side. They may be, you know, talented in other areas, but they don't know squat about web development. So I'm like you. I'm bilingual in both, and I'm quite proud of it.
Yeah, and I think for me in having studied, because I don't have a degree in computer science. My degree is in marketing. And
So I wouldn't have thought that.
Yeah, and so I've had to grapple with this because I'm like, when do I get to own the title technical? And Scott and I had this long conversation once because he was on a podcast.
Oh, I think you can own it now.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, about 2 years ago, he was on a podcast, and this is so interesting. He goes, and we were listening to it. We were on a long drive over Thanksgiving with kids in the car, and they were sleeping, and so we listened to this podcast. And Scott, you know, our origin story, and Scott goes, yeah, Andrea is mostly our marketing person. She does sales and she does the administration, and, you know, she doesn't really do much of the web development. And I paused the podcast and I was like, why did you just say that? I was like, I do so much of the technical stuff around here. I build the website. You know, I'm the one who came up with all of the structure. Like, you know, I'm coining these terms. Like, there's no way I can do my job and not be technical. I'm like, was really frustrated. And so Scott then told me, he goes, he's so patient and very quiet. and just kind of let me get my feelings out. And then he goes, well, Andrea, I used those words because that's how you introduced yourself in a client meeting yesterday. So as soon as you start calling yourself technical, I will too.
So you were self, I don't even know how to say this. I mean, you were kind of putting yourself in a box where you didn't need to be.
Yeah, I was
good point.
Succumbing to what's called stereotype threats.
Yeah.
And so I had been told kind of over and over and over again, girls are bad at math, girls can't code, girls can't do computers, girls can't do this, girls can't do that. And
oh, I heard the
every
same
time
thing.
I would
guess where I am.
Yeah. And I mean, every time a client asks me, so do you code? It reinforces that stereotype threat. Like, you don't look like somebody who's supposed to code. And so I would fall back into what the stereotype was. And so,
That is really sad. I'm glad you came out of
it. It's sad. Yeah, and so what I ended up doing was getting a JavaScript tattoo on my wrist that says that I can be anything, and no one's asked me if I could since. But here's the thing, is that that stereotype threat goes the other way. Because we tell engineers, you're antisocial. You can't communicate. Like, if we look at all of the pop media culture around somebody who codes and is on computer, it means you're brilliant at math and you suck at people.
You
and
know,
Scott
I
was
think
very,
the same thing. I did.
Yeah.
But a couple of my friends are brilliant engineers. I mean, brilliant. They're funny. I mean, they're just smart, smart people. They think at a different level than most people do. And that's when I say you guys are different, that's what I mean. I mean, you just think at a level that a lot of people just go, what in the world are they talking about? But once you understand engineers and you really take the time to get to know them, I have not met one that I just didn't go, man, you want to be my friend? You are cool. We have a lot to talk about.
Yeah. So I think that instead of saying, are you technical or non-technical, which the question itself reinforces stereotype threat. It makes you choose where you belong. And just by saying that, like, I feel all of a sudden, oh, I'm not very good. So now the answer that I've come up with is I'm both. And then that kind of jars people. They're like, what, really? And I was like, yeah, I communicate, I write blogs, and I also can get down and dirty in the code. And, I think that that's the way that the world is going. It is no longer acceptable for people to not be able to communicate with each other. Like, we're working on cross-functional teams. People who code need to have social skills. And people who come from traditionally soft skills backgrounds need to learn how to code. It's becoming, in a generation, my kids, like, this is going to be the equivalent of them having to know how to type and use a computer. It's just going to be that ubiquitous. If you look at GE, for example, all of their new I just saw an article the other day about how all new people who start at GE are going to have to know how to code. It's becoming a job requirement, just like, being
and that makes
able to
sense.
Communicate.
Right.
So
it does make
it's
sense.
No longer an either or. It's everyone has to have both. And we can be stronger at both. Like, I would say that I'm less technical than the other people on my team. I'm stronger in some of the soft skills. And, my strengths are I'm really good at, patterns, and I'm really good at, being able to put together a metaphor and a story. And that is good in software too, because you have to create models and you have to name them. And so there are a lot of the skills that I have that I can use in marketing and storytelling that are directly applicable to building software.
Of course. So how did you decide that all of these skills that you have, and you're very young to have really been able to identify your skills. I'm sure you know that, right?
I don't think I'm that young.
You're young. Trust me, to be able to identify, and I'm not saying I'm ancient, but a lot of people don't identify that they have these, and you said soft skills. A lot of people, you would be amazed, Andrea, how many people I would say, okay, what are your soft skills? And I just see light bulbs, or nothing, just what is a soft skill? And it's so often in my world, and you know, the world that I populate in business, your soft skills are almost sometimes more important than your hard skills. You can learn hard skills, but those soft skills are who you are. And I mean, just the fact that you're mentioning those and you're kind of embroidering those into what it is that you do, you know, in your business and with your team is very, very important. And I hope you will, you know, kind of sit and think, yeah, she's right. Once you have a chance, it's really important.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, one of the things is that I think I'm just a self-assessment junkie. I love taking all the personality tests and, like, Myers-Briggs. We do StrengthsFinder for everybody on the personalysis and DISC. And I just get really curious about what are my strengths. And I really liked kind of the methodology of StrengthsFinder, where it says focus on your strengths rather than trying to beef up your weaknesses. And I also, another place was LinkedIn, because I got about 30 different LinkedIn recommendations and I started seeing themes. And one of the themes is like, Andrea is one of those rare people who can be both analytical and strategic at the same time.
Right.
And it was like, I didn't even know that was a skill until people started pointing it out to me. And I'm like, other people don't do that? That's just how I see the world. So
I think
sometimes it's helpful. Like, I would recommend to everybody, like, if you want to learn what you're really good at, like, ask 50 people for a recommendation on LinkedIn,
mm-hmm.
and then you'll start to see patterns. And so I was like, okay, well, if this is one of the things that I'm good at, then I should find roles where this is where I should be playing. So
exactly.
Yeah, and so in terms of StrengthsFinder, my top strength is strategic, so seeing the big picture, futuristic, so I live 6 months ahead, which is also really good for a CEO, positivity, I am really happy and a good cheerleader of people. I'm like, we can do this. What's the other one? Oh, activator. So, which is really interesting, because my strategic brain, which is like, I want the white space and the blue skies, and I just want time to think. I have another strength where it's like, go, 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 you have to do this now. And so sometimes they battle each other. And then my last one is woo. So I genuinely love meeting new people. I get very energized by having conversations like this, where it's like, yay, new people. And in the book, it says, in your world, there are no strangers, only friends you haven't met yet. And that's me to a T. Like, I love going to conferences. I love just genuinely meeting new people. And then there are other people on our team, you know, who, like, one of the people who's helping with operations, her strength is harmony. And so, you know, that is a lovely strength for somebody who wants to create systems for how things will run smoothly, right? And she just is very analytical. But that strength, harmony, which most people kind of fluff off and say, what the heck does that mean? It's like, no, she is the glue that kind of holds us all together. And she's really good at kind of documenting and saying, okay, well, there's a problem here. What if we did this? So I think it's looking at those strengths and recognizing that you can have quote unquote soft skills and they can be applied in a hard skills environment, right? We need empathy
Absolutely.
In software. We need harmony in software. We need all of these different human skills in software, because machines are good at one thing, but like, we need the humans who program the machines, who tell the machines what to do. They're not, you know, so, and that is where the creativity and the collaboration all come to play.
And that makes perfect sense. I mean, it's not, you know, where you want to sit down as a business person or an SEO and just kind of issue edicts, like fix this, hack that together, you know, somebody do this. I mean, you have to really kind of sit with your people on both sides, your employees and your clients, and truly understand what has to happen and what's going to make everybody happy so that it does happen seamlessly.
Yeah. I like to say sometimes that I read the book Team of Teams by General McChrystal, and he coined a management style in there called Eyes On, Hands Off. And that is very much me. Like, I want to see what people are doing. So we've got a lot of documentation, like filling out your timesheets, we do daily journals, so everybody writes what they're doing every day and then shares it with the team.
I was going to ask you about that. How does that work, the journals?
Yeah, so we have we use a wiki that we have for all of our documentation, and every single person just has a wiki page, and they just add to it every day. And so it's, you know, today I was really excited. You know, we had a team meeting, and it went over well, and we talked about the retreat, and Nikki showed us this really great house, and, you know, somebody said this. And so it's basically what my day was like from my perspective. And then I post a link to it in a retrospective channel in Slack, and everybody reads it. So then it works great, because then that way, you know, most of us, it works well for people who are very introverted, you know, and who may not feel comfortable sharing in a large group, but that information is really, really, really helpful. And it's also helpful just to get into the culture of reflecting and planning. So at the beginning of every day, everybody posts a stand-up meeting or stand-up. So they say, this is what I worked on yesterday, this is what I plan on working today, and here's what has me blocked. And so it could be like, I'm sick, I don't really feel well, or I have a doctor's appointment in the middle of the day, so I won't be available from 2 to 4, you know, whatever it is. But just being honest and saying, here's what it is. And so planning your day ahead of time, and then at the end of the day, before you close up, reflecting and saying, here's what happened this day. You know, it can be some personal stuff like, oh, I noticed I was a little anxious today. I wonder what that's about. Maybe I'll meditate a little bit more. You know, maybe I'll go for a run, you know, but just then that way people know how to support you as well. So I like to say that we are in the culture of preventing fires rather than fighting them. So, you know, I think that when you create a culture where people are habitually planning ahead, taking things slow, calming the chaos. Calm the chaos is one of our core values. And then just sharing kind of your point of view and sharing where you are. It's something that we tried for a week. We have a very big culture of experimentation. So we tried it for a week and everyone was like, oh my God, this was so transformative. And I make sure that I write a retrospective as often, you know, I try to do it as often as I can. It's a daily practice for me. And it's been not just a good daily practice, but then that way the team can see what I'm doing, because otherwise so many CEOs kind of end up operating in isolation where nobody has any clue what I'm doing during the day. And at least this way, it like lets people in, and giving them a chance, like I'll get messages and it's like, hey, Andrea, you know, I've noticed that you're the one who's doing a lot of sales activities. Would you like me to cover any inbound sales leads while you're out on vacation next week? I don't think anybody has that. And like, so it's enabled us to allow everybody on the team to be proactive on each other's behalf, and which is awesome, because then problems don't become problems. They just solve themselves before they become problems.
So I'm guessing that you don't have a big turnover.
We have not had anyone leave voluntarily. So
oh, my gosh.
We have had to let a couple of people go because, I mean, we do have a lot of demand. I mean, it's a culture that if you can't toe the line, you know, if you can't
show up and do the work.
Basically it's like, I can be hands off because you're hands on. Right. So we've had a couple of people who came through and they weren't showing those artifacts of their thinking. They weren't filling out their daily journals. They weren't filling out their timesheets regularly. They weren't putting in their stand-ups. They weren't committing regularly. They were keeping everything on their local machine so that I could see, okay, work is going on, things are good, and I can kind of see things globally. So if you're not, you know, if you are somebody who doesn't like to work in that environment, then it won't be a good fit. And we had tried to work with couple of people and it just, you know, it wasn't the right fit. So we do have high expectations, but at the same time, the people who like doing that and kind of who do that type of work energy anyway get a lot of autonomy, and it works really well. So but yeah, we haven't had anyone who has voluntarily left. So we've had a little bit of turnover though, for just to make sure that we've got the right though.
So it sounds like you have a heck of a business environment. Listen, Andrea, where can people find you on the internet?
So you can go to Corgi, like the dog, BORGI, and then Bytes, like the computer Bytes, B as in boy, Y, T as in Tom, E, S as in Sam, CorgiBytes.com.
Okay, and there's anybody else wants to know about any of the other links that we talked about, they're in the show notes. Andrea, thank you so much for being with me here today. I enjoyed it. I thought it was wonderful chatting with you. I've enjoyed it,
thank
and I know
you.
Our audience enjoyed the takeaways as much as I did.
Awesome.
So, well, thank you
thank
so much.
Thank you so much, Denise. I appreciate it.
You...
Bye, everyone.
Listen, everybody, the show will be available for download in about an hour, and you can also find us in iTunes. Just type in our names, Denise Griffiths and Andrea Goulet, like Robert, she says. And I will see you next week. Thank you, everybody.
You can find Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com or at gottagovirtualnow.com. Thank you for joining us on your Partner in Success Radio.